ATL Jacob. Dungeon hot room in the summer, and Jim Calhoun has traveled up.
Yeah.
Well, we'll get into it.
Here with Nick Hannah Medley on Big Timers. We're coming to you live from Portland, and this is someplace you normally come back in the off season, but it's a little bit different this time around, right? So I guess we should just start off with that. Like, why are we here today?
Yeah, we're here today. You know, I'm officially retiring from basketball after 16 years playing professionally. The time has come, so. You know, it was a pretty easy decision for me, although I have another year on my contract, have a 2-year-old girl, and the body just spoke. You know, I knew kind of going into last year that it was getting towards the end. I was taking it on a game-by-game basis, you know, and I just knew. I had a lot of vets that told me, you know, when the time comes, you're going to know, you know, and that's the time is now, you know, so it's a bittersweet time, but, you know, excited to kind of reminisce on things and, you know, for the next stages of my life.
Yeah, so last time we had talked, you were coming off a championship and thought about walking away then, right? You decided to come back.
Yeah.
Looking back, do you kind of regret that? Like, do you think you should have walked away on top?
Or? Well, you know, it's easy to feel good when you win a championship. You know, the euphoria of it physically. You know, I felt like with a good summer with Kobe that I'd be able to put myself in a position to have another year. But then I got to training camp, and, you know, on paper it sounded good. On the court it didn't feel quite as good. So I knew in training camp, you know, tried to play early on in the season, and my body just was telling me it was time. And, you know, having another year on my contract, I tried to stay a part of the group this year and, you know, be a part of kind of like a, you know, player coach, being supportive to my teammates. My coach was a young coach, so did a lot of stuff with him to just stay involved with the group. You know, I knew that it was time. You know, my body was really clear with me that it was time for me to hang it up.
So the biggest thing, just your body telling you
that was like, it. You know,
what about the mental aspect too? Because I'm guessing that's a drain as well.
I still love the game.
Yeah.
You know, and that was a big part of my whole career was really just. You know, really loving playing. Some of my favorite times were during the summer training, the work. You know, I really enjoyed the work, that process, and the camaraderie Kobe and I had throughout the summers, putting that time in, you know, was one of my favorite parts. So mentally, I still felt fresh. I still felt motivated, you know, but it was really a physical thing. You know, and sometimes as an athlete, as much as you put time and discipline you put with your body and your diet, it's also important to know when it's time. And me and Kobe talked about it. Kobe was at my last game, and he said, look, you have the opportunity to walk off the court, or realistically, you're probably going to leave on a stretcher. You know, and it really comes down to that type of point where you push it. You know, I had vets that told me, and I really took heed to it, to play as long as you possibly can. I mean, when I was 34, 35, my body would, you know, you already start to have that downtick. You have to do a lot of things with your diet. You have to do a lot of extra things with your training. It takes a lot more preparation before every practice. There's a lot more that comes into your routine with it. You know, but it just, you know, I'm really grateful that I was able to sit down right now and talk about how I'm done playing and be able to walk off the court and have it be on my time as opposed to have it taken away from me, you know, with an injury or something like that. So I'm really grateful that I was able to, you know, really make a decision, and it didn't happen abruptly. Like, to play 16 years, you know, I have, you know, throughout my career, there was two things. There was one, I wanted to play as long as I could, and the other was to not have any regrets. And the thing in this moment right now that I'm most grateful for is that I genuinely don't have any regrets. You know, I know for a fact that I put in the work. I made the sacrifices. I did the things that I had to do. With the plate that I was given, with the cards I was dealt, I feel like I maximized every opportunity that I had. So, you know, I'm grateful that I'm not gonna look back and have what ifs and regrets and, you know, stopping when I was 34 and saying if only I'd played a few more years. You know, I'll be 39 in October, and you know, I was talking about it with my dad last night. You know, if you take into consideration my time at Deering, you know, we're going on 25 years, you know, of really being committed to the game. More than that, close to 30 of just being all in, you know, and it's an all-in endeavor, you know, to play at the highest level is, you know, it's an all-in endeavor on and off the court. And so, you know, I'm grateful to be, you know, again, it is bittersweet, you know, to know that we joked about it. You asked me about a 3-on-3. Like, when I say I'm never going to play basketball again,
yeah.
not me and Jade, she might get some ones out of me,
yeah.
Right? Like, horse, pig, but I'll never run up and down the court again and play a game. You know, I really, you know, I gave everything to the game, left everything on the court, and, you know, feel really comfortable walking away.
And you can still walk. Like, you're not limping around here. Like, you still look like
exactly.
You're not.
Exactly. I'm not limping around when I'm not doing anything. Like, if I went out and played 3-on-3 right now, the next day would be, you know, there'd be some soreness. But now I feel really good. So, able to play with my daughter, you know, over the years. So, it's great.
What was it like finishing up the year knowing that you were going to be all done and just, you know, it had to have been a grind to get to the end? And knowing that's going to be it, but you
yeah.
still want to give it all to your teammates. Like, what was like? What were those last final games like? Knowing like this was going to be it.
For me, it was the process was a good runway because last year, I promised my wife. I mean, it's been like every year. I've been like, this is my last year because
yeah.
I've really taken it on a year-to-year basis. Like, go into the summer, do absolutely everything I can during the summer, really commit my body, the diet. I mean, as you get over 30, it's all about your diet, you know, and the commitment to. You know, you can have a cheat day, you know, from time to time, but really that's the biggest discipline in you know, the later stages of your professional career is the diet. You know, especially when you've had accomplishments and you've achieved a lot of the things that you've wanted to achieve, to still have the motivation to do the things that aren't easy to do. You know, I just had a lot of tailwinds with inspiration from people around me that made it easier, but it was definitely tough down the stretch. And I had that last year where it was going to be my last year.
Right. And you won a championship.
And then we won the championship, yeah. And then it was like that one more year, you know? Like, my coach and the organization was great, and my teammates were great. And so they offered me a 2-year with a few months left before we even won the championship. So that commitment that they made to me at that age, knowing that they gave me a 2-year contract at 37 years old, you know, it meant a lot to me that they respected my discipline as a pro, to know that I wouldn't take that opportunity for granted and I wouldn't steal checks, and I'd show up in shape and work. And I did. I mean, I had a great summer last summer coming off winning a championship. I recommitted myself mentally and said, went into it thinking maybe I'll play 2 more years. You know, maybe I'll play till I'm 40. And then came to training camp and it was pretty clear that wasn't gonna be the case. Yeah.
So normally whenever you get done the season, you start looking forward to the next season, right? It's all about getting ready for the next year,
mm-hmm.
stuff like that. Now you don't have to look forward to, like, have you thought about what's in the immediate future? Like, this is the first
yeah.
time where you gotta actually, you're not planning for basketball, like you gotta plan ahead for the rest of your life. Like,
yeah,
you
this is, to be fair, this is a special moment for
yeah.
me. Just having this conversation you know, I always, kind of envision what saying I'm retiring from basketball would feel like and what it would look like, you know, to sort of be in the moment. You know, I feel like it's the closure element too. I don't feel like until this moment as I announce my retirement and, you know, kind of walk down memory lane with my friends and family, you have that closure, and that closure is important to me to be able to turn the page. You know, so the last few games, it was pretty emotional, knowing on the way to the game, like there was a lot of reminiscing. Like some of my last games, especially the year that we won the championship, you know, remembering, you know, times in early stages of my career, I had so many things to motivate me. So I always carried those with me and, you know, it helped down the stretch and made the process smooth for me. And so now as I kind of have this closure, it is different going into the summertime, but there's so many things that I'm looking forward to with family, being in the States. You know, it's one of these things where when I come back during the summer and we're with friends and family, it goes quick, like 6-7 weeks.
Yeah.
And for 16 years, you know, being in the U.S. 7 or 8 weeks a year, it goes really quick. But when you look back, I mean, I haven't had a lot of time home, you know, and I love home. You know, I love being here. I love spending time with my with my family and friends, and now I have a 2-year-old daughter. So really the overall emotion is excitement, having more time to spend here and new challenges, and I'm really excited about it.
No more basketball though.
No more playing. No more playing. I want to stay involved in the game. And it's a big deal to me to share my experiences here in Maine, and find a way to stay involved in the game, with relationships I have. The biggest passion I have is sharing experiences with young players, the process, the disciplines, what it takes to be a pro, not only here in Maine, but also other players that are about to go down the same path I went down. I just want to share kind of some of the things that I did that helped me be successful, because I feel like paying it forward is a big deal. It's always something I committed to that, with the success, I'm going to give back way more than I got, and that's a big deal for me. And that's something that I'm going to really commit to and hold myself accountable to. The things that you get on the court from basketball, I want to feel like at the end of the day, that I gave back, a lot more than I got. And so I got a lot of work to do.
I think we should reminisce a little bit and go back. So we got one of your childhood friends and teammates at Deere, and we got Walter Phillips joining us. Walter, how far back do you guys go? And any insight you could provide us on Nick at a young age, because we're going to cover what he was like later on and everything going on now, but take right. us back.
So I met Nick, I think fourth grade. I think we were probably in fourth grade. We were at Longfellow. I had just got done with, I did a year at St. Patrick's. So I think that was my third grade year. And then my mom moved me to Longfellow that year. And I was already playing Little League. We were playing like Little League baseball, but I hadn't gone to Longfellow yet. So I think that's where I first met him, was at Little League baseball. And then that following fall, I went to Longfellow. And then we were the only two fourth graders to play on the sixth grade team for Lincoln. So we had to play, we didn't play like the regular rec like the kids have now. So we had to play for Lincoln. So we had to go up there. I don't remember if Janet brought us up there, Jamal's mom, mm-hmm. but Maul was in fifth grade, and then me and him was in fourth grade, yep. and then we ended up making the sixth grade team.
And Dick Gagne was the coach.
Dick Gagne and Mark Madison
yep.
was the coach.
Yep.
So that's where we first did it.
You mentioned Jamal too, so like obviously you guys are well known for your time with Deering, but what was it like coming up? Obviously you guys came up together, so like what were the early basketball memories coming up?
To be honest, Jamal was just different. Jamal, like me and him, we were really close because we were close in height and size and all that stuff, but Jamal was just, he was already 6'2", 6'3". So we were kind of like, sometimes we wouldn't tell him we was going to play. But we just always played. I mean, we played, my dad used to run Riverton Open Run. So we would always go in there, we'd always play against the men. Him and Janet would run that, and then, me and him would play every day after school. We'd always lower the hoops. We'd play at 8 foot every day because we'd have to go to practice, but we always wanted to dunk. So that's the only thing that we wanted to do after school all day. We would play for hours on hours on hours. We used to play at a place, I don't even know if they got the hoop at the fire station. So he cheated all the time. Come on.
I mean, I'm interested in what is, how did I cheat?
So what we would do is we do 3-on-3, mm-hmm. and you get to pick the three people you were.
Right, and so then, it's two people playing 3-on-3.
Right, so we play 1-on-1, but it's 3-on-3 in your mind.
Right.
So you can pass the ball. So what would happen is, you know what I'm talking about. I would stop him in the corner, and then he would just drop the ball back in his hands, goes, I just passed it. I'd be like, yo, come on. But no, we did that at Fire Station, and then we would go to our coach Mark's house, who was the only person that had the adjustable hoop, and then we would play there until finally Mark sold us, sold you guys.
Finally Mark said, I'm tired of you guys being outside of our house every day, all day, dribbling. Just take the hoop.
Yeah.
So me and Walt just took the hoop and dragged it a few miles to my mom's house.
Yeah, so we all
uphill
the way
both
down,
ways.
All the way down
in the snow.
No, so we went down Ledlow. We had to go down Ledlow to Glenwood. went all the way down Ledlow to Glenwood.
Yep.
Wow. So that was like the young stuff.
One of the things I love about Portland, especially like when I was coming up, I was a little bit after you guys, but it was all about coming down here and getting a run outdoors in a park or something like that. Yeah. So I'm guessing you guys used to go around, go park to park.
Yeah.
At what age were you guys like rolling in with your five? Or were you guys on different teams? Were you guys trying to be in the same team in the park or what?
No, because we was both young. So it was like Hank, Big Hank, Tiger, guys like that. Like guys that were, was it Charles Mason?
Charles Mason.
Warren Johnson, like guys like that. But like, so my
Dom's dad.
My dad knew most of those guys, and I knew most of the guys, well, we both did, because we would go to the open run. So they would, so you had to go to Payson Park on Saturday morning. Yeah. Like that's where the run was at, 8 a.m. If you, you know, there'd be people.
And
people
then during the week too, five at night. That place would be packed. And now Payson is a ghost town.
Yeah. Well, it used to be fenced in.
People don't play outside anymore.
It used to be fenced in, and you'd have people like hanging off the fence watching games.
Yeah.
So we, the thing with us was that we always played, like we started dunking early. So it wasn't for anything for us. You know what I mean? So we could play with the guys because we were still playing at the rim. You know, most kids that are 12 and 13 years old, they're not playing at the rim. Me, him, and Jamal, we started dunking sixth, seventh grade. So there was nothing for us to go to an open run with guys. Plus, we had already been groomed by both of our parents.
Yeah. And obviously, you guys were on a rock star high school team, the Daring team with Jamal. You guys were kind of like Miami's big three before Miami. I'm guessing like the environment was crazy when you guys would go around just playing these teams in Portland. Like, what were some of the environments like? We saw a little bit this year, like fans starting to come back after COVID and fans being in the gym. But I've seen footage of the gyms whenever you guys were playing. Like, what was it like going around the city back then with the rock star team you guys had?
Man, that was incredible. I don't think it's ever gotten back. I don't think it ever get back to that. I think about how good Cooper is, and I see the fans that they got him. But I don't think anybody's going to touch what we was doing. And it wasn't just us. It was about the competition that was around the city.
Yeah.
You had to do it. Like, there was no other way. There was so many other – there's so many other avenues to see players now. For us, it was – I would say it was harder for us because we played against people that were playing Division II, Division I on every team we played. You know, but for us, it was just, you know, me, him, and Maul. But every team we played, they had a Division II kid or a Division I kid. And we had to come and show out. And then once the crowd got there, I let Jamal and Nick worry about the basketball stuff. I worried about all the other stuff. I worried about the crowds. I'll deal with them. You know, I'll deal with the other teams and stuff like that and let them do what they do best.
So now with like social media, everyone's seen, everyone can be seen at any time. It's a little bit tougher like when we talk about 20 years ago, right? There's not as much footage, but I got my hands on some footage today and I remember you from back in the day. So I know you were about back then and we're going to have some stuff coming out here, but let me ask you this.
What's up?
Did these guys hold you back? Because it seems like you could have been the star on those teams, Walt. I've seen the highlights, man. It seems like they might have held you back a little bit. You were in that Chris Bosh role.
No, not at all. No, I mean at no point, because it was, for me, it was never... And for them, it was never a question. It was never a question that that either one of them ever not have my best interest at heart. And at no point did they ask me to do something that I wouldn't do for them. I think they made me, you know, just as good as I could be, and I tried to help them be as good as they could be. So it was never a point where I felt any type of slight or any type of anything. Nothing. Those are my brothers. I mean, I knew them. I've known them my whole life. So I wouldn't even ever think that way. It would never come out that way.
Was anybody touching you guys in the city back then?
As far as grown men?
Like when you guys were in high school or grown men. Because
that's the only competition you had.
I was going to say, once you guys were in high school and you guys were a little bit more grown, you started going around trying to find runs. Like you guys probably didn't
know. Oh, no. That stuff was too much fun. That stuff was too much. Because we would bring other guys in too. I mean, it wasn't just us. I mean, you know, Levy over there, you know, Wooly, Wood. Everybody would come up, and we ran the city, I mean, as far as ball once we were at that point. I mean, it was just, we learned from guys that had played pro and played overseas, and once we got to the age where we were 16, 17 years old, it wasn't anything. It was over at that point. It was our time. You know?
There was some pretty good, the one team that I remember, the one AAU team that I remember that was competitive was Ralph and Dan Hammond's team, and then Brunswick. They had a great group. Like, they had some kids that were, you know, competitive and weren't intimidated. So that was a great group. And then Bangor, you know, with Zach and Joe, like, they had a good group. So we had a lot of, you know, a lot of good players during that time period. You know, and in Portland, South Portland, you know, you talk about Chris Markwood, You know, but there was a lot of players that could play. Mike Ward could really play. You know, and then over at Portland, you had Pills was a hell of a player. You had Saphir and Ikoka Coleman. Like, there was a lot of players during our time period that, you know, it was a great time for Maine basketball. And I think that, you know, we mentioned it earlier, but we've seen it now as the players in that generation have been able to start coaching and with AAU teams, with training, have started to give back to some of these younger, new generations. It's been an impact and a big part of, I think, some of the success we're starting to see with, you know, players in Maine continuing.
You guys had a bunch of highlights on your team, just with you two and Jamal. Like, what's the craziest thing you've seen this guy do?
Oh, man, I got so many. I got so many. Well, I'm trying to think what my favorite one is, though. I think my favorite one, and Coach, you know about this one. Valley was on a run where they ran about 80 of them straight.
I remember this one.
You guys played them?
We played them.
AAU team.
But it wasn't official. So, Coach, I know at least two or three times you tried to get them to play us. They would not play us. So we played the fall league, and we played them in the fall league, and I think we won by like 20 or something. But this man caught Brian Andre so viciously.
Hold on, hold on. Paint a picture real quick, because Brian Andre might not be known by the younger kids nowadays.
Right.
But,
so Brian Andre probably, at the time, probably 6'10". He gotta be 250.
Yeah, he big was boy. A big fella.
250, big country.
260.
Big country.
Yeah. 250, 260. I still remember it because I still wake up with nightmares. I feel bad for you. So they was running a 2-3, and the twins was on the top. I was on the wing. It was at Wyndham. I split the 2-3. He came down baseline side on the left side, just like I always do to you. I dropped it off to him. And I'll never forget it. He went chest to chest with Brian Andre, and I think I yelled in Brian's face louder than he did. And that one was like, and I think we won by like 30, and they like never wanted to play us ever again. So that was probably a good one. Just the stuff. I mean, I remember I got hurt my senior year, and the first game they played without me. He had 38 in the first half. He had 7 threes. Like, I think the time that I was out for 6 games, he averaged 52 and 26, or 48 and 26 in the 5 games I didn't play. Like, that was insane in itself. And then the 3...
I can only play in the 3 quarters because we were up by 20.
Right. You had the alley-oop 360.
Oof.
Yeah, the alley-oop 360.
I appreciate the love, but can we talk about Walt, though?
Yeah. I want to hear a Walt story.
We're talking about the career and all this, but Walt's bounce from middle of middle school through high school are some of the most. If we had the social media that we have now,
I have 100,000.
Bro, so the one against Ryan Belanger in Summer League at Southport.
I had to give it to y'all. I know, man.
Bro, that was one of the dirtiest dunks I've seen in my entire life.
Yeah.
I mean, he caught him, his body hit him outside of the dots.
Yeah.
And then just fell kind of down him as he raised up. And it was one of the best dunks to this day I've seen in person.
Yeah, because what happened? Genuinely. What happened was we all came up together, and my dad made the decision to send me to Chevres instead of Deering my first year, because I played at Chevres my first year. You still didn't get no wins. We only won 4 games that year, Levy. But yeah, so we played them in summer league, and I got a break, so I had to let. I got Ryan on a fast break, and I turned him out. I got him pretty good. But that's what we did, though. I mean, I remember we used to have practice. Remember the Joey Marsh story?
Oh, man.
So we used to, in practice, Coach, we had a meeting before practice every week, or every before practice. So we would literally sit there before Coach came in and would choose people that was getting dunked on before practice. So we would all be in the locker room talking about, no, you getting it today. No, you getting the business today. No, you getting the business today. So Coach came in while we screaming at each other, shut up. Joey Marsh is going to get dunked on today. So Joey came up from freshman because he was a good freshman. So the way you get done is that transition drill.
Three on two, two on one.
So they put Joey in the 2-on-1 with me and him. And Joey, being a good kid, was trying to show himself that he was doing something. Man just coming down, he's put to take a charge on Nick. And Nick just jumped over him and dunked on him so hard. And this guy goes, "All right, drill's over, I win." That was hilarious. Classic. I was just thinking about that a couple of days ago. That's hilarious.
Craziest thing, like being here now and him just getting done playing. Like, you think that back then that he'd have the career he had, or you don't at all surprised?
The funny thing about that, I was actually kind of thinking about that today after he called me, and I really and truly believe this. I'm not surprised at all, just because the simple fact is that it's not anything different or anything that we didn't think that was possible. You know what I mean? It's like, even when we were kids, it wasn't like what if or what. It was like, when this happens, this is how we're gonna move.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the way we was insulated, Levy, myself, Maul, well, all these guys, we never thought that there was anything different. You know what I mean? That's just how we thought. It was just, and it might be something that, in Maine, it doesn't have that same effect on people. It doesn't, little pockets. But we never thought anything different. We never, like, I was trying to think about, like, if you guys asked me, like, were you surprised at anything that he has done in Maryland or anything? I was like, nah, not at all. I know him. I know what he's capable of. I knew what his game was. And it was never an option to be like, well, are you surprised he's this good at the, no, not at no point. At no point was it like, he's doing something that's this incredible. This is more just like, yeah, that's what he's about. That's who he is. That's what his game has always been. So it was never a surprise for me.
So the third piece to the big three is Jamal. And I went back and looked. So you guys are the only teammates to win Mr. Basketball back-to-back years, right?
That's what held me back.
What was it like having Jamal as a teammate, and have that help you develop as a player and ultimately push you to be the player you
became? Yeah, I mean, he was, you know, both of these guys were a bar for me, you know, at a young age, 7th, 8th grade. You know, and like we talked about earlier, you know, when I knew I had to work, it was then, because these guys were really talented, you know, were really competitive, and for me to be able to compete, I had to. And so Jamal was extremely talented. I mean, when he was in middle school, I think he was probably one of the best players in the country. And again, now, when you look at something like Cooper, the way that players are evaluated is a lot different. There's a lot more exposure. At that time, there's a lot of similarities. Jamal reminds me a lot of Cooper at that age. He was ahead of his time. He was more developed. He was just, his energy, he was better than everybody.
Yeah.
When we went to AAU tournaments, when we went to, you know, New England, when we played in all these different events,
he was always
the guy. And so he was somebody who was a bar for both Walt and I. He was always the best player on our team, you know, pretty much my whole career. He was the best player on the team when I was in middle school. He was the best player on the team my freshman, sophomore, junior year, you know. So he always was the guy, and so for me it was a great opportunity for me to learn how to be competitive and have to work to, you know, when somebody's right next to you and they're better than you, and you know, it's obviously something that drives you, it makes you want to be better. So he was a big time influence in terms of my motivation to get better, because Jamal, man, he always, to this day, I mean, he still trains kids and is still part of Maine basketball, but he was a very talented player and one of the best high school players in the history of Maine, for sure.
Well, I'm going to ask you one more question. You don't have to answer it if you don't want to, because I've talked to him about it. It's got to be a sensitive subject.
Chad's like, oh, he's going to answer. Chad, like, he's going, what's up?
The greatest state championship game I've ever seen is probably the toughest game you've ever played in. You want to talk about the Bangor Deering game? Because I saw a clip today. I saw footage, an angle of the shot that won the game that I'd never seen before, and it's like, it still gives me goosebumps. Like, you want to talk about the ending of that Bangor Deering game?
I wouldn't say that was the toughest game we played. I really wouldn't.
Toughest loss.
Probably the toughest loss to take, but I don't think that was the hardest game. I think playing Woolley and Levy in the Civvy was the toughest game we ever played because we just knew each other so well, and Carter came up with a great game plan. And we were just able to sneak out that victory. But they'd gone to the state championship game the year before that. So they was already prepared for that. And they had already prepared for us. There was no, intimidation. You know what I mean? Levy was not backing down. Woolley wasn't backing down. None of we played each other. Middle school, elementary school championship, middle school championship. We played them in the state championship. You know what I mean? So that was probably the toughest game. But getting back to what you're talking about. When I think about, I think it's the best loss I've ever taken. The reason why I say that is because we still get ranked in the top 10, even though we lost. And everybody knows the reality of the situation.
And it's like, you're not top 10. You're not 10 either. Like, you're in the top 10, but you're not near 10.
Like, right. So it's like the loss, and the reality is, if we had won it, it would have been forgotten. You know what I mean? We would just they were a great team. They went undefeated, blah, blah, blah. The fact that we lost, people still talk about it to this day. They still talk about it. They still have, like, conspiracy theories. It's like JFK. You know what I mean? It's like JFK. Like, how did they lose? What did they do? Like, who made the mistake? So if you think about it, that game is still one of the most popular games that's ever been played. You got the Bedard Coney game where he went crazy, like a triple overtime game or whatever. And then there's our game. So, I mean, that's probably how I can best answer that. It's just that. It's an absolute classic of a game. And the loss is what it is. I mean, it is what it is.
We had 20 years this year, right?
Yeah. Yeah, 20 years, yeah. No, it was 20 last year. 21, yeah, it was 21 last year.
From the Bay Area.
All right, so we got Coach here now, and we heard a little bit from Walter about what it was like with those teams traveling around and stuff like that. But I want to talk about, like, the recruiting process and this guy getting coaches coming in and stuff like that. As his coach, you probably were the first one to hear from these guys, right? You probably talked to a lot of these coaches. Any crazy recruiting stories about Nick when he was coming through?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I appreciate you asking. So just kind of set the framework up a little bit, I got the job Nick's junior year. So I was at it a little prior. I knew these guys prior to coming over and knowing there was a plethora of talent there, and was certainly given the Porsche, let's say, from day one. Yeah. I mean, you're dealing with Division I. But back then, there was recruiting rules were different. So they weren't allowed to reach out to Nick or to any of our players until, I think it was October 15th. Mm-hmm. So the influx of the cell phone had just come out.
Yeah.
They could call me, but they couldn't call him. So I was getting calls from all over the country. I tell the story all the time about I got a call in the fourth hole at Gorham Country Club from Bobby Knight. He was at Texas Tech and asking if Nick would be interested in looking to come into Texas Tech. So those stories were certainly ongoing. I realized quite quickly once he decided his senior year to go to Maryland, that Mike Franco wasn't all that important anymore, and I think they all lost my phone number at the same time. Yeah. But it was certainly interesting. It was crazy times. Walt will tell you, as well as Jamal or anybody, that we had the big time coaches that were at practice every day, were there quite regularly, which certainly made it easier for us as a coaching staff to challenge these kids to play hard. I mean, Mike Bray's there from Notre Dame, you don't have to really get the kids fired up that we're playing a team that we know we're probably going to be successful against on Friday night on a Wednesday practice, because they're going to get after it. So that was fun. There's some funny stories, probably not for this particular type of venue, as to some of the recruiting things that went on, but I certainly enjoyed it for the most part, but was really happy that he made a decision prior to his senior season, because everything stopped. When he was going to Maryland after they won the national championship, he was so focused on what was going on. It was his senior season. We didn't deal with the recruiting as much. We dealt with other things, but we didn't certainly deal with the recruiting as much.
Yeah, and I've talked to guys like him, like, who have had offers and just what it's like to start receiving letters and how cool that is. As a coach, though, it's got to be kind of cool to start getting phone calls from these other coaches and stuff like that. Soon did that get old, though?
It didn't really get old because I was kind of enjoying it. I was like, all right, so these guys that I'm watching on TV are reaching out And I was just the mouthpiece for him.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was interesting to see some of the recruiting tactics that were used. He would get hundreds of pieces of letter from, I think it was Stanford that sent you, like, there'd be 100 letters that they'd mail out in one mailing. So my mailbox was completely jammed every day with letters for him, and he never opened any of them, at least I know of. You know, he was kind of to the point of, if they want to talk to me, if they want to see me, I think he mentioned earlier in one of the segments that the Dana Pump, the Pump and Run guys that he was affiliated with his California connection was a great tool. It didn't certainly affect me as much, let's say, with they communicated through his AAU coaches more so than I. But I had fun. It was, but I continued to tell a story to a bunch of my old timers and say, yeah, it's crazy that Gary Williams and Roy Williams and all those guys that had offered for him to go there. I mean, he was offered every team in the country. I think the only ones that you might, that I don't think, you could correct me if I'm wrong, but Carolina was one that you never...
Carolina and Duke.
Carolina and Duke were the only two that you didn't... So that's, for me, as a 35-year-old coach in the state of Maine, hearing from... I mean, I remember when he committed. I had to call Roy Williams and tell him that he's decided to go someplace else. I had to call Jim Calhoun, which was fun.
Yeah.
But again, they didn't call me back.
He thought you were boys.
I thought we were tight.
We were building a relationship. Yeah.
So you're not going to put in the matchup that we've been running in the out of bounds place that I've been running for Nick Lobbs. You're not going to run those? Okay, I get you. I'm on. I'm settled.
But what was it during that time period, just seeing how he handled it, that you knew he was going to be successful long term?
Yeah, that's a great question. And again, I met him through playing or early on, and then I got the job in September. I believe Walt was with him, and Nick and Bo Belanger, who was another player on the team, came in. And all they wanted to do was win. And unfortunately, in the couple of years that I was there, or Nick and Walt and Junior Senior, we didn't capitalize and hang the banner, because that ultimately was a goal. But they, as a group, were vested in each other. They were vested in the experience. There wasn't a lot of behind-the-scene drama that took place. As you mentioned earlier, we were fortunate enough to have Mr. Basketball Nick's junior year, was a senior, then Nick was a senior, was Mr. Basketball. Walt could have been Mr. Basketball. We had other players on the team that were as talented. There were some other talented kids throughout the state, but you know, it was a fun time. Certainly I know that these guys, because Jason's probably saying that he won as many state championships as they did.
so did Coles.
Right? But the ultimate, I hope that as they look back in their career, and I hope Nick, who certainly had a successful pro career and a great college experience, that he doesn't look back at the high school not winning the state championship was a letdown. What you guys did, or what the fingerprint that you put on the state of Maine in basketball, you talked about, like Walt said, and you guys were mentioning at the other segment, you talked about it all the time. We were an undefeated team that lost at the buzzer. And you mentioned earlier, I was listening, and if I'd have taken him out of the game, well, you could watch the film again. I hit him on the foul line, we were up three, and you get your over the back foul with 2 minutes to go in the fourth period. Poor coaching, well, you can blame it on me. I should have had him off the line, back on defense. He never would have got the over the back foul. But you know, that's just one of those hindsight 2020 things.
Great experience, great learning experience. You know, we had a great group. To coach's point, we didn't have any behind the scenes drama. We, you know, came up. That's the beauty of high school basketball, is these are people that you played with since you were kids. And it was just a great experience. And the fact that we didn't win a state championship, to me, when I look back, again, like Walt said, I wouldn't change a thing. Because those experiences taught me what it took to win a championship, to win. You know, it was never a situation on the damn homie in high school, you were the man, homie. Like, we didn't get it done in high school, but then we went on, won an ACC championship, won a few championships as a pro. So I'll take that all day. And at the end of the day, you live and you learn and you find ways to get better. And those were moments that made us all better as men and built our relationships. Because to be at that age and have to kind of deal with that and go through that, to lose at the buzzer as an undefeated season, and then after the game, we had some things happen in the hotel, you know, where a couple of us got suspended. you know, based upon what happened after the game. And those are all learning experiences that, you know, if you have that happen at that time, then they don't happen in college where it's more consequential. Right. Then it doesn't happen as a pro where you have money on the line. So at the end of the day, it was great learning experiences that I certainly wouldn't change at all, and really grateful for all of them.
It's one thing to send a kid to D1, send a kid to Maryland. It's another thing to see a former player be an All-CC player. At what point at the next level you're like, damn, like this guy's gonna be special at that next level too?
Well, as earlier mentioned, you know, it was often talked about, well, is he gonna play? Is he going to, you know, he's getting all these offers, and is he good enough to, well, certainly he was. And, you know, talking to the coaches throughout the recruiting process, I mean, he was gonna play wherever he went, and he made the choice to go to Maryland, which still sometimes today, I don't know that we've actually had a conversation about it, why Maryland became the place, because I know we had visited Missouri, and there was other places that you visited, but that he played as a freshman. He started every game but one in his entire college career, which is bizarre, right? Remember going over for the draft party, we were crushed that you didn't get drafted.
Yep.
But immediately gets the call about signing and, you know, trying to a contract, Detroit, a player, restricted contract, and then he got hurt. But for the last 20 years, I get up every morning, and I check to see how my player did, or how Nick has done. Try to stay in touch with him through communication. Super proud of him, and he's the most giving, humble, respectful person in his position. I mean, you heard the list of players that he's played with and the accomplishments that he's had. What he's going to give back to the state of Maine in the next 10, 15, 20 years. I'm hoping that you move back to Maine. I know that you said you only got a place up in Freedom. So maybe we can get you to buy another house. Walt probably can help you with that. He's probably got some real estate pull. But, you know, he's just been, for me, to be a small part of what he's been able to accomplish, to follow his career, has been awesome. And if you see him with his daughter, if you see him with his buddies, he hasn't changed from when he was 16 years old. He's still the most loving, humble, giving. He's a little bit taller now than when I first met him. He's got a little bit more money in his wallet now than he did when I met him. But I'm super proud of him, and I certainly wish him the best as he moves forward. Super proud.
Good deal. Anything else?
I appreciate it.
Yeah?
Yeah, that means the world to me, honestly. You know, when I look back at my career, the relationships, you know, that's what it's all about. It's what drove me. It was my motivator. Through a majority of my career, Levesque and I were talking about it last night. There's been a lot of players in Maine over the last few decades with a lot of talent. A lot of talented. You talk about that Valley team, Nick Pelock, you know, these are guys who, you know, could really, really play. And that was a big, big motivator for me, is when I got on that stage at Maryland, and even as I went on in my professional career, it was representing so many players that I felt like in Maine were better than a lot of the guys I was playing against.
Right.
So I felt like I was, and it was a unique opportunity to play and feel like you were playing for more than just yourself. I always felt like I was playing for the state of Maine. I always felt like I was wearing that kind of flag on my back. You know, it wasn't just about me. And that was special. That was something that's been special throughout my whole career is, you know, Cobes and I talked about it a lot during the summer. It's not easy a lot of times to get up at 7 and work out during the summer, you know, when you're good, when you've set yourself up for life after basketball. But the motivating factor was knowing that there's so many guys and girls from where we're from that if they had that opportunity, they would have been the first ones there, the last ones to leave. So that's always been the chip on my shoulder. It's always been representing the state of Maine. And so to retire now, I'm just proud of where Maine basketball is at. You know, and the opportunities for us all to continue to give back to the game and bring the culture of basketball with what you're doing with Big Time Hoops is really incredible for young players, to give them that platform. And to be able to, you know, have that canvas for Maine basketball to continue to write our story, because it's still early. I really believe that. And I think that when we look decades down the line and you look back at Maine basketball, I'm humbled to be somebody who will be a part of that history. And then as we move forward, I think there's going to be a lot of you know, players, boys and girls, who are going to do some big things. And you already see it happening. And You know, so for me, like Coach said, is, you know, moving forward, I'm going to spend as much time in Maine as I can. And, you know, we've built True, and that's something we're super passionate about. This will be our 12th year, you know, and that's really what it's all about at this point. You know, it's kind of been my mantra is it's not what you gain from the game. It's what you give back, you know, and so that's going to be something I hold myself accountable to moving forward. And that's what I'm most excited about. Like I said, when we started, like, yeah, it's bittersweet. Like, I'm retiring from the game, but also it's an opportunity for me to be able to, you know, share all these experiences and continue to kind of relive it through other players, you know. Although I'm not able to play anymore, I'm able to share experiences that are going to manifest themselves through other people's careers, and that'll be exciting and fun, you know, and that's what's next.
There we go. Good. So having been a pro for so long, like, you really don't get the chance to really reflect and look back on stuff, right? Because you're always preparing for next year, getting ready for next year. But now you got some time, and, like, you just saw some footage, some college footage that I saw too for the first time in a while. Yeah. Like, looking back on it, have you had a chance to, like, kind of reflect, having gone through this whole journey, like, during the Maryland years, like, stuff that sticks out? Because you went into two number one teams in the country and won on their home court, right? And played well. At Duke and Florida, like, those are probably two things that really stick out. But you have anything in mind that comes to mind in terms of just looking back at the Maryland years?
Yeah, I mean, it's been one of the coolest parts of, you know, having closure in my career, is kind of walking down memory lane and, you know, reflecting back. I told you when I got some of that footage from the video guy at Maryland that he sent over that I hadn't seen the Florida game, like the actual broadcast, and never really saw any broadcasted games. I'd watch the games after the video guy would give us, like, their footage, not, like, the actual broadcast of what Dickie V and you know, the way that they did the entire game. But it was really interesting to kind of just watch the games, because I don't remember the games, like, the details. So it's almost like an outer body where I'm watching a young version of me play, and I don't remember what's going to happen next.
Yeah.
You know, so I had no recollection of even that overtime in Florida. We were, you know, down by a few. I had a few buckets in overtime. Gilchrist had fouled out. You know, Doris Burke was on the sideline.
Young Doris,
yeah. And she did, like, this little segment on me, and it was really cool. I mean, it's been really humbling to kind of look back at some of those experiences in college. And as fast as it goes, there's so much content. There's so many experiences, you know, from my freshman year. You mentioned the game that we won in Florida my sophomore year. We won the ACC championship that year.
Yeah.
Which was a huge deal. I mean, we came in, so when I came out of high school, Maryland was the number one team in the country because they just won a national championship. So for us to be able to be a young group with those expectations and then come in and win an ACC championship, which Maryland hadn't done in a few decades, was a really big deal. And so that experience, and then our junior year to win that game in Duke. And then we had some unfortunate things happen with some guys with injuries and with academic issues. But overall, just being able to reflect on some of these times has been one of the funnest parts of just kind of this entire process over the last couple weeks as I start to really wrap my head around. You know, it's one thing to think I'm going to finish playing. It's another thing to say I'm retiring from the game of basketball. You know, I mean, it's really surreal even to be in the moment and say that because you know, I've been doing it for so long, and it's been such a big part of my life. So it's you know, been really fun to start to watch some of those games and appreciate some of that stuff now, looking back.
And you were there, like, at the last, I feel like the last, like, golden era of the ACC when it was, like, teams sticking around for, like, 3 or 4 years, right? So you had, like, the J.J. Redick, Sheldon Williams, Duke teams, the Rashad McCann, Sean May, Raymond Felton, Carolina teams, the Chris Paul, Wake Forest teams.
Yep.
Who else was there when you were there? We had a fellow Maine, and we had Mims at Florida State while you were there.
Yep. Mims was after me.
He was probably there for a couple of years.
Yeah, there for a couple of years. Yeah, it was a great time in the ACC. I was really bummed when Maryland left the ACC.
Yeah.
You know, because the ACC is not now the way that it used to be, just based upon the way that it's broken down with some of the Big East teams and, you know, with Maryland leaving the ACC. But that time, the years before me leading up with Jason Williams and the Boozer teams and then the Juan Dixon, Steve Blake, you know, it was a great time, to your point, in college basketball, and to be able to be a part of it and play against those guys, Chris Paul. We had some battles. JJ, you know, had an incredible career. You know, so that was a great era for college basketball. You know, and to be able to be a part of it and have the role that I did on Maryland was a lot of fun. I mean, I went in there and coach remembers when I left high school that there was a lot of chatter about, you know, transferring back to Maine and, you know, what does he think is going to happen at Maryland? He's not going to be able to contribute. And maybe this isn't what everybody was saying, but this is what I was listening to. I had selective hearing.
Yeah.
So that really motivated me. And so to go in there and be able to start as a freshman, you know, and have some of those moments early on in my career, and then just the overall experience over the 4 years there was incredible. So, you know, it's great to kind of look back at it.
One story that Doris brought up during the Florida game was that you dislocated your ankle, like I think your freshman year, and they needed two people to push that back in. I don't know if we ever talked about that on the previous times we had you.
No, that was actually a really pivotal moment in my career. You know, it was in the Sweet 16 against Michigan State in Austin, Texas. And, you know, that was with Steve Blake, Drew Nicholas, in that team. And I stepped on somebody's foot, and I looked down, and the bottom of my foot was facing this way. And I looked over at JJ, and I was my trainer, and I'm like, "It's a wrap. Get out back." My dad comes with me. They cart me out, and they were pinning my leg down, and they were trying to manually put my foot back into place. Out back in the locker room, that wasn't working out. So they took me to the hospital, sedated me, and my dad told me that they tried numerous times. They had some protocol of how many times they could try before they would do surgery, which would have been, you know, a lot longer of a process. Yeah. It would have been screws. It would have been, you know, a big process, but they were able to get it back into place. I think my dad had a big part of that. You know, he was down there just...
He said, move out the way.
Yeah, he was getting after it. All right, Doc, I got this one.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that was a big deal. And then I ended up having, I didn't know it at that time, but when I dislocated my ankle, I had a very, very small microfracture that I ended up playing my entire college career with. And the training staff, because I would get x-rays, they thought it was just arthritis from the dislocation. And they were like, you're going to have discomfort, you're going to have pain. But I actually had a microfracture in my foot from the rest of my career at Maryland. And I didn't find out about it until I signed with the Pistons in summer league. And then, you know, had just through the amount of work I put in with the pre-draft process, it just broke more where then finally I ended up having to have surgery and was out for my first year out of college. But, you know, it was a pivotal moment when that happened because it definitely changed the trajectory just based upon the fact that I had that fracture in my foot.
So around here, when it comes to high school basketball, there's certain fan bases that have reputations around here, like especially in the Portland area, like some crowds aren't as nice as others. Maryland had that reputation too, right? At least from an outsider's perspective, but you played there. What were the Maryland fans like?
Yeah.
Did they cross the line a lot, or were you like,
it was interesting because Maryland fans were really ruthless. They were tough. And then there'd be the fan bases like Duke that, you know, we talked about this before. You don't take it too personally. You know, they're yelling at the XY axis of the vertical. And you're like, you know, but then at Maryland, they're like at your mom, your girl, you know, they're very, very vicious. And some other crowds too, Virginia, some other schools that don't get talked about as much, Florida State. You know, I heard some ruthless things said to DJ Strawberry with his dad, you know, being Daryl Strawberry. Like people would say wild stuff, you know, but... It's just part. It comes with the territory. I loved it, to be honest with you. I loved it. When I went to Florida, when I went out before the game, I was the first one. And they said it in the broadcast that we'd showed up super early because Gary Williams had always studied the art of war. And so he always wanted us to be the first ones to the gym. So we would get there really early. And so we were out there as the fan section came in. And I'm not really sure why, but I came out. And it was the whole fan bowl that was there, and I was the only one out there shooting. And the first thing I did was just straight to everybody in the entire crowd.
Yeah.
And they were, I mean, if you can imagine, I'm on the court warming up, me and my assistant, with 10, 15,000 students just rah. But it actually ended up dialing me in more because I had to, like, then I'm like, oh shit, now I actually have to shoot and, like, you know, get my warm up in. So I was so dialed in with that warm up process because they were on me so heavy. But it was, yeah, they were a rowdy fans. But Maryland was one of the toughest places to play, I think. You know, Cole Fieldhouse was known. That was when I came in as a freshman, they had just built the Comcast Center. So we played the first game in the Comcast Center. They went from like this kind of like smaller, hot, you know, rowdy gym, and Cole Fieldhouse had a lot of history, and then built this big 18,000 person Comcast Center. And so, yeah, it was a great experience, and you know, it was great to have them on our side for sure, because they I heard some funny stuff with JJ, man. They actually had his phone number at one game, and so they had his cell phone number that they had up. So it was fun, man. That was a fun part of the process.
One of the things we talked about too, I think in the first podcast, was that the infamous video of the Steve Blake fight, right? Yeah. In pickup, was it with Gilchrist?
Yeah, it was with, so Gilchrist was my roommate, and Blake had kind of taken us under his wing as a freshman.
Yeah.
And we're at, and the thing you don't see in the video, which is the funniest part of it, I guess funny, but for, you know, probably the worst part of it, if you look at it from a different perspective, is it was the kids' camp. So
there was kids watching.
We would play the counselors, the players would come out and play at the end of camp.
Yeah.
So the whole crowd was parents and 8-year-old, 10-year-old, 12-year-old kids. Like, I never knew. We love you, Steve.
You can't tell from the video there's anybody in there.
You thought it was like a closed, like, you know, scrimmage for, you know, just the team, but it was for the camp with a bunch of kids.
Yeah.
And so that was one of the reasons why I broke it up quickly. But like I told you, I'm grateful to say one of my biggest regrets in college was breaking up that fight.
Yeah.
I wish I'd let it go. Yeah. But I was trying to look out for my boy Blake, because, you know, I don't want to, you know, because I bet Blake will watch this, but it didn't look good because he got caught with the right and he buckled a little bit. And that's when I was just like, I called it off. I said, we got to get him out of here.
Yeah. You mentioned some other guys that kind of came through that time, like Juan Dixon and Steve Blake, obviously. Who else was there? Brandon Mouton.
Taj Holden. So Mouton was there before, the year before me. He was a senior.
There's a bunch of talented dudes that were coming through Maryland at that time. Like, was everyone coming back in the summertime? Like, was you ever played with, like, Steve Francis? Steve Francis ever come back?
And then at the relationship I built the most was with KD. So KD was at Montrose Christian. So KD, my junior year, I think it was the summer before my senior year, KD would, Grievous Vasquez and KD would come play with us. And he was young, obviously, and super talented. And, you know, you could just tell, the one thing I tell a lot of young players is how hard the greatest players work. I mean, KD at that age was, you know, he'd come way before, he'd want to play until, you know, as players, we're a little bit older, like, we played 40 games, you know what I mean? And KD's still trying to play, get shots up after, you know, and he just had that work ethic and that, you know, competitiveness at that age. And so, yeah, we had a bunch of people come back. We had Steve Francis would come back. There'd be some Wizard guys that would come, Juan Dixon, Blake would come back because he was drafted by the Wizards right out of Maryland. And so we had some great runs during the summertime.
Biggest regret or biggest thing you wish you would have done at Maryland?
I would say, looking back at it now, learning, I you know, really one of the biggest things over my career was learning what it takes to be a champion and really what it takes to win. You know, that's one of the biggest process that you have as a pro, and in your journey is learning what it takes to win at the highest level and to be a champion. And you know, in Maryland, my junior and senior year as a leader, I was a gym rat, and I spent a lot of time working out, and I felt like a lot of the group was a little bit more distracted and had a little bit more of a social life during the season. And I think it affected the results for us. And if I were to say one result as far as winning, I wish that I would have been a little bit more vocal about that. I wish I would have been a little bit more vocal about the decisions that some of my teammates were making. Because as a pro, I would have never let that shit happen.
Right.
You know, like, if you're going out the night before a game or two nights before a game, you know, as a leader and as a winner, you don't let that shit happen. You know, you hold people accountable. Like, had a great time in college, as a pro had a great time, but there's a time and a place for everything. The night before big games is not the night to go out.
Right.
The night after the win is the night to go out.
Yeah.
And so, you know, those are the things that as a pro I would you know, hold teammates accountable, and the veterans that I played for that were winners, or played with that were winners, you know, would hold guys on the team accountable. So I would say if you look at it from a regret perspective, that would be one of them, that I wasn't more vocal at that age. But I was 19, 20 years old, you know, and these were my guys. These were, you know, my roommates. So, you know, you live and you learn, it's not a significant regret, but I just think as you learn what it takes to win and be a champion, you can look back and say, well, you know, that may have been where I could have been a little bit more vocal and, you know, in those situations.
So one of the craziest things when doing some research for this was going back and looking at your class of 2002 high school rankings and who was in there and where you were. So you were like, what, top 80, I think? Anyway, Andre Iguodala was right in front of you. He was ranked right in front
top
of you.
Top 80.
Yeah. Carmelo must have been number one. I was surprised Darren Williams was ranked number 100 in your class somehow. But anyway, like most
so
of
So obviously the rankings were straight trash.
Yeah.
Is what,
yeah. But
is what it really comes down to. It's talking about I was top 80.
Yeah. But yeah, the crazy thing is,
you top 80, but went to the national champs.
Yeah.
Top 80.
But crazy, after all this time, those guys, most of those guys were all been playing, and you just got done. So one of the craziest things about you is your longevity, which you've been working with Kobe for how long now in terms of just getting ready in the offseason?
Yeah, 15 years.
So what has been your approach, or like what's your secret to keeping this guy?
Before we even get into that, I'm going to tell you a funny story of those rankings, right? We've been longtime friends for pretty much as I played basketball. And it was a difficult journey to see that he was the best in the city, for sure. And it was even remarkable journey to see him even get to the heights he's been. But there was a McDonald's All-American roster came out and didn't mention Nick. And we were actually together with this. I don't even know if he remembers this story. So we were together, and this thing burned him up so much that he goes, let's go to the gym right now, right? And we were still playing. I'm still high school kid, 18 years old, and we grab a camera, and we go down to the YMCA, and this guy puts on one of the most epic dunk competition relays. Must have reeled off four or five dunks that you would have just said, oh my goodness. And that was right after just hearing it. That fire, that drive, it's always been there. It's always been there. But talking about some of those, that rankings, that's what just, you know, gave me that memory of, we took that, you know, recorder and went right down to the YMCA, and this guy had some dunks that, man, I wish we had the footage. But we've got the stories to talk about them today. I'm talking about between the legs, double windmill. I mean, Harold Miner, it was a performance.
You know what I would say about those rankings, too? It's great to see how much better the analysts have gotten over the years. I mean, because when you look back now, and that was one of the challenges being from Maine at that time, was there wasn't any other players that had come from Maine and played at a high level in Division I and made an impact. So there really wasn't any cadence to what a Maine player looks like, right, or taking the competition seriously in Maine. So a lot of the things that I was doing my junior and senior year from the rankings perspective wasn't appreciated the way that it would necessarily be now with the way that the national circuit is. Because when I look back at the players that were in those rankings, and you mentioned it, a lot of these guys didn't even play professional basketball. You know, so if you're somebody who's doing the rankings back in high school, and you got a guy who's top 10 who didn't even play professional basketball, I don't know if they had their job for that much longer.
They probably
weren't that good at their job.
Yeah. So it takes a lot of work to be great, right? But it takes a lot of work to be great for a long time. Like, what's been the thing you've been most impressed with him being, putting in the work for this long and being able to play at this level for the amount of time he has? Like, what's impressed you the most?
Of course, there's been countless things that have impressed me over the decades. You know, the dedication and the approach has been, you know, by far something that's been dialed in for over a decade. And when, you know, you think about what it takes to have prolonged success, it's about the time that's not taken off, you know, and it's been an incredible journey to be alongside him, you know what I mean? you know, the dedication has been a real thing. And it's, you know, you want to say something other than the plain facts, but that's it. It's an everyday thing. And that's what's so incredible about having this moment and, you know, hopefully the moments to come is, you know, the time that was dedicated to the game is able to be able to now be shared and share these experiences with other people and give back to the game. Yep. But it's a whole time that you don't get, you know what I mean? And he's given that to the game of basketball and also to the state of Maine back, you know, back, giving back to, you know, the future generations, which is remarkable in and of itself.
At what point did you realize, like, this is a job and you got to put in work? Like, whenever you couldn't just rely on, like, natural ability and stuff like that? Like, when did it become, like, a job for you?
I mean, I knew at a really young age that I was going to have to work to be good.
Yeah.
Because of some of the guys that I grew up around, you know, Walt and Jamal. Like, we spent so much time playing at a young age, and the talent level that I was playing against at that age, you know, I don't know. I think the state will see it again, but hasn't. Other than that time period was pretty special. And our tight-knit group, if you talk about Portland, some of the players that were there from Pills to Kobe's brother when he was Mr. Maine Basketball, that generation of athletes from Levesque and Wool at Westbrook, and with our group, like, I knew at a young age, in order for me to be considered the best player in Maine, like, that's where it started for me. So when in high school, I was 6'3", maybe as a freshman, 6'4". So I wasn't the best player, even necessarily in of a few year period. Kobe and I were talking about this about Cooper. Cooper's one of the best freshmen in the country. When I was a freshman coming in, I wasn't even necessarily even on the radar in Maine. You know what I mean? And it's because there was so many good players in Maine. When you look at generations ahead of me, the Bedards, the A2 Ganleys, like, these guys were the guys, they were the bar for me. It was high school and college players for Maine. Those were the guys in Blodgett, for example, that I was looking at. So I knew at a very young age, in order for me to be who I wanted to be, which I wanted to be the best player in Maine, you know, and then I wanted to be the best college player in the country. And then when I played in Europe, I wanted to be the best player in international basketball. Each step, I knew it was going to take a lot of work, and it started in high school. I mean, I knew just to be able to compete against the Westbrook teams and do what I wanted to do, I was going to have to work. It wasn't like at that time, it was just me dominating, you know, from as soon as I came in, just domination. Like, my freshman year to my sophomore year to my junior year, it was relentless work, dude. I mean, like, the amount of time I spent in the gym, we didn't even spend time in the gym, just playing the game of basketball.
Yeah.
And I try to tell that to kids now and they don't understand. We played basketball all day. Like, we'd go to Payson, then we'd play outside at our house, and then we'd go to the Y, we'd find places to play. We just played all day, nonstop. And so it was just committing to trying to find ways to get better. And I was really, really fortunate to have great people around me who were honest with me and who didn't tell me I was great. They told me all the things I had to do to be great. And it was great to have those type of leaders in my life. And I was fortunate to have my peers, my friends, my brothers, my coaches, who were not only peers, but also leaders, because they told me what I needed to hear, not what I wanted to hear. And so that was a big deal for me at a young age. And so, you know, I knew what that work was going to be a big part of my success very early.
And it all paid off. Obviously, you spent a lot of time over in Europe. I'm guessing the goal was ultimately to get to the NBA at some point. I don't know if we've talked about this on previous episodes, but, like, at what point did you accept overseas is where I'm going to be, this is where I'm going to make my living, this is where I'm going to make my money? And was that a hard decision to accept?
Yeah, it was. So out of college, it was, you know, I felt like I was one of the best 20 players in the country. And I felt like the success or the lack of success for my team, my junior and senior year, based upon things that were a little bit out of my control, as far as winning goes, were a factor as far as the way that I went through the draft process.
Right.
But I had a great opportunity with Detroit and a great group and a really good agent at the time who, you know, their GM at the time, Joe Dumars, was a big fan of my game and wanted to have me be part of the organization, and went into summer league and unfortunately broke my foot. which I already had, you know, a fracture that I then learned had kind of been like healing during the summer and then re-aggravated in the season for my, through my junior and senior year. But that took me out for 8 months. So that obviously, when I signed with Detroit, it obviously derailed that part of the process. And then I came back for with Sacramento in the summer league. Had a great summer league, and then signed with them, went to training camp, played in the preseason, and tore my AT band and missed a few months. So it was really a timing thing with injuries, which at that time, to be candid, 2 years out as a pro, you start to look at life and you start to say, I'm doing this professional. So if I'm doing this professional, I need to make money,
yeah.
Right? Like, so 2 years out, not having any consistent income, it was time for me to go make money, and I had a great offer in Spain. And that was the first year I went to Spain, and it gave me a perspective and understanding of how fragile opportunities are. And then going to Europe for 1 year, I understood that like there's the highest level of Europe, and then there's everything else. And so just getting a small taste of that, I knew that it was a major opportunity. And so then when I went into the next summer and played summer league with the Clippers, with you know, Blake Griffin and Eric Gordon, and had a few double-doubles and played really well. And their GM at the time was Dunleavy, and they had Steve Novak on a qualifying offer, and he felt pretty confident that if I went to training camp that I'd have a pretty good chance to make the team. But I had a multi-six-figure offer to go back overseas to Europe. And at that time, because I'd had the experience I had with injuries, I just felt like it was best for me to go where I had some guaranteed trajectory. And then after 1 year and another year, it just really, to me, became about where I was appreciated. And so it wasn't really an accepting thing. For me, it was more of a pride thing. And it was a success thing where I've gone over here and I've had a lot of success. The people appreciate my game. And if in the NBA, which at the early stages, before I knew about what other opportunities looked like, it was a goal, but then my goals kind of changed. So I just kind of readjusted my focus and what it was that I was trying to do, and said, okay, now I want to be one of the best players in international basketball. And then that was a whole new path of work, you know, and Kobes and I had a lot of conversations about what it was going to take.
Sure.
And so we got to work and were able to accomplish quite a bit.
Yeah, you mentioned getting to the highest level, and you were top five in Europe 1 year. You were an MVP finalist in the Spanish League, which is considered the second best pro league in the world behind the NBA. One thing I thought was interesting was that year you were all Europe top five, right? And there was Patrick Beverley in there and Sabonis in there.
Jonas Valanciunas, yeah.
Yeah, at any point, like, while you're over there and you're playing at a high level and you're seeing these other guys eventually go back and play in the NBA, like, any frustration on your part, like, I'm better than these guys, but they're going back and playing in the NBA? Or was it more like just satisfaction knowing that you could play on that level and be better than the guys that are playing in the NBA?
I kept the blinders on.
Yeah.
You know, I was so focused on what I was trying to do. And at that point, I felt like the game, in every year I've been in Europe, so if you look at it 16 years ago and then so like clip it at like 10 years ago, European basketball has had more of an impact on the NBA with more and more players coming, more and more guys from the NBA coming to Europe. And I got a taste of it, and I understood that I could be really successful and set myself up for life by really committing myself to being great in Europe and internationally. So I started to really not pay really a whole lot of attention to the NBA and just sort of turn the page and said, look, here's the hand I'm dealt, and I want to be one of the best players in international basketball, you know. And so that was my main focus, and I was studying, you know, what are other players doing, who are the top agents. One of the biggest parts of my trajectory was understanding what you had to do with your brand as a player to make yourself a desirable asset to the top teams in Europe. There wasn't a lot of room for error because you had 1 year contracts. Where in the league, you have multi-year deals. In Europe, it was 1 year, 1 year, 1 year. So you had to be successful.
And the clubs are very competitive, too. Right. It's a really competitive atmosphere in practice. You know, it's been remarkable to kind of see the transformation of his game as well, yeah. and having a hand in that.
Yeah, touch on that. So, like, you mentioned how you have to change his game, like going overseas and being there. Like, what are some of the things you've seen change?
Well, you talk about the sacrifice to be successful.
Yeah.
You know, and some of those things are, you know, coming out as, you know, a slasher athlete, you know, maturing into being a scorer, then having to transform to be some one of a top defender, and then be a playmaker. And then later on, you know, be an unbelievable productive shooter, and then transform to, you know, leadership role. To see somebody wear that many hats for that many, not just clubs, but successful clubs, that means those traits are being, you know, looked at by major GMs, basketball operational people, and winning programs to bring somebody that's able to kind of sacrifice whatever it is you think you do into a culture of winning and right. to be successful. And that's one of the things that's been just a trademark for Nick Cannon-Medley, is to be the sacrifice guy, to give of himself for the team, and ultimately having that team success define his personal success.
So two questions for you. So having been over there for so long, you've probably seen a bunch of these young guys, 17, 18-year-olds, kids that are from there and then come to the NBA, right? So having seen these guys so young that have come here and been successful, you think you have a good eye for talent? You think you could spot these kids? Because there's probably a bunch that were, like, hyped over there, came over here and wound up being bust. But there's a bunch that probably were good, came over here and did well. You think you have a good eye for talent? You could evaluate.
And the
talent.
Other way.
Yeah.
And the other way. Guys that he's seen, you know, early.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, me and Walt talked about it with Jimmy Butler and James Harden early, having a good eye for talent and being able to understand. Yeah, we can go there later, Walt. But, no, like, when it was something I was passionate about, I still am, life after basketball. It's something I want to do is be a part of the evaluation of talent and building winning teams. That's something I really love, you know, on and off the court with stuff I've done in business. I love building team, identifying high character people, how alphas can all collaborate for one common goal. And so, yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of guys, like Luka is a prime example. So Luka was in Madrid when I was in Spain, and in Madrid for a couple of years, and played against him a number of times. And it was really clear to me at him as an example. Another guy was Porzingis, another guy was Sabonis. So Sabonis was my young fellow when I was at Malaga. He was 17, and you know, I could tell that he was an elite rebounder. He was an elite worker. I knew that he was a pro. And that's one of the things that when we talk about bringing back to Maine and with our program with True and the mentorship program of helping teach young players what it takes to be a pro, you see it in guys at a young age. I mean, it starts when you're 16, 17 years old. And Sabonis at that age already had all those characteristics. He already had that work ethic. Same with Porzingis, same with Luka. These guys were mature beyond their years. So when I saw KD at 17, when I saw Sabonis at 17, Jonas Valanciunas, Luka, I mean, it was obvious to me that these guys were gonna be great.
I got one for you then. Well, what's the kid in Spain right now, like the 17 or 18-year-old kid that's supposed to be like the number one pick in a couple of years?
France. Wem Blinyaka or whatever his last name is.
Yeah, so go out on, give me your talent evaluation on him. Is he gonna be the number one pick and be successful in a couple of years?
I would say if we're gonna do a stack, first of all, the first disclaimer with people that are that tall is it's all about your health.
Yeah.
It's all about if you're gonna be able to stay healthy. It's very difficult at 7'3". To have a handle and play like a guard and stay healthy in an 82-game season, that would be my concern. You know, but when I look at his game, I think that with his length and what he's doing now against grown men at 17, I think it's fair to think that he's going to have more upside than a guy like Rudy Gobert,
yeah.
right? Because he's more of a scorer, shoots it better than him, has the same length, plays way above the rim.
He looks huge.
When you look at a guy like Chet Holmgren,
yeah.
I would say if I had to put those two against each other, Chet has more dog in him. So Chet has that like real shit to his game where I think that he's gonna be able to find his niche and grind. But where I think Wem has it is he's just longer, bigger, a little bit more skill set. Be interesting to see, but I wouldn't give him the cosign. So to your question, like I would cosign Luka, young Luka, young Porzingis, young Sabonis. I can't give that same cosign to young Webb, not quite yet.
We gotta wait and see.
Yeah, we gotta wait.
And spending that much time overseas, and you talk about coming back to Maine and like helping basketball moving forward here, like what are some things that Europe does good that you could implement here that you could see we could do better here?
I mean, I don't know if it's even a Europe thing. I mean, for me, like the number one thing I'm passionate about, and I have been for quite a while, is again, giving back to the game here. When I was growing up, the people that I looked up to were high school players and Maine college players. They were the people that were in our inner circle here growing up in Maine. There wasn't professional basketball players that came back. Well, there weren't any professional basketball players, period. But there weren't guys that were, you know, part of my life when I was young, and having that to sort of understand and learn from their experiences. So for me, that's a big deal. And Kobe and I, and as we've built True, you know, that's been a major inspiration for me, is just sharing the experiences, sharing, whether it's European basketball, Maryland, high-level professional basketball, it's the disciplines, it's the decision-making, you know, it's the sacrifices. You have to be willing to do things other people don't want to do. You know, I mean, it's cliche, but you just have to be great. There's a lot of talented people. There's a lot of good players. You know, but it's really as simple as, you know, you have to look yourself in the mirror and be able to say, how bad do you want to be great? You know, and if you're willing to look in the mirror and you can do what it takes to be great and to win, you know, it's a satisfying experience, and I want to be able to share, at least from my lens and from my experiences, what that looks like in Maine, and to me, that's a major motivator, and I'm going to hold myself accountable to that. And I also, if there's any example I want to set for future generations of Maine basketball, it is what you do when you have any level of success. Because I really genuinely believe, when you look at a guy like Cooper, when you look at guys like JP, some of these young guys over the next few decades, we're going to have NBA players come out of Maine. There's no doubt about it. And the question is, what are these guys going to do when they have that success? And I hope I'm able to have an impact, and with them coming into our program last summer and seeing the example of, hey, come back and give back to the game in Maine. Help us build that culture. We've talked about that with Big Time Hoops. Is Maine basketball culture is new. Like, there's been a lot of great players in Maine over the years, a lot of great high school players, a lot of great college players in Maine, and sort of continue to build on those legacies. It's about bringing in guys who have had the opportunity to go see other places, to go see success in international level basketball and here in the States, and then give back and share those experiences and lessons. It's a big deal, in my opinion.
All right, I got one more thing for you about overseas, and this is your chance to vent if you want. All right, so being overseas for so long, people back home kind of lose sight. Like, I try to find what you've been doing over there, and it's tough. Like, I checked the Wikipedia page, and you even said that's not accurate, right? So I'm looking at stuff that's not even accurate. Any frustration, like, doing so good overseas for so long, and it not really being known back home? Like, people might not even know that, to be honest, like, that you're just retiring now. Like, any frustration, like, with the lack of that?
I don't think it's frustration. For me, it's motivation.
Yeah.
For me, it's motivation to, you know, and again, with something like Big Times Hoop, this should be motivation for all of us as we talk about the next steps of Maine basketball. Is it's pretty unique. When you look at other states, from, you know, New York to Florida to California, there's decades and decades of history of basketball success. Guys who have played in the league, guys who have gone overseas and been successful. In Maine, we haven't had that. So we're really at that point right now where we've started to build that platform and have understanding of what that takes with trainers, our generation, coaches, giving back to the game, which just creates momentum. And so I think that that's, you know, a big part of it. I don't feel like it's, you know, there's any, like, you know, ill will around it. I just think that, you know, it just underlines the fact that the culture of Maine basketball is building, it's growing, it's innovating, it's new to a certain extent. Like, life outside of Maine, as far as basketball, is relatively new. You know, because, like I said, when I was in high school, the people that I looked up to were high school greats, college greats, people that went to UMO, people that went to Bates, people that went to Kobe, people that went to USM and had great careers. Those are the people that I looked up to. Those are the people that inspired me. So now, as we take steps and have more and more people that can come share their experiences, I mean, that's super unique. What a great opportunity to have a place where there's 50 states, 51 states, right? Like, to be able to be in a state where it's in the early stages of building a basketball culture, it's a great opportunity. So I feel like the young players who have success, I want to be part of setting the tone for what that looks like, you know? And I will underline the free part. Like, again, I said it to you when we were talking offline, like, if you are a professional basketball player, don't come back here and charge kids for anything. Like, how much money do we need to make from the game? Like, Maine hasn't had the opportunity to have the trajectory of understanding and learning. Like, to build a platform that's free and to give back to the game, that to me is the thing I'm most passionate about moving forward. So we talked about, I think that some of the things that we talk about and share, like, this will be new news to a lot of Maine fans now, because they don't really have any idea what happened throughout my career. But I just look at it as an opportunity to continue to help younger players, parents learn what it takes to be successful. I really don't care if you know exactly what I did, as long as you'll give me the opportunity, whether you're a parent, a kid, a coach, to share my experiences and help young athletes understand what it takes to be a pro.
Yeah. So I think the word, like, the word right now is momentum. Like, Maine's got this momentum we've never had before, right? Because of all the good things and all the young kids coming up right now. But with that, there's a lot of hype out of what's going on now, what's happening now, who we have now. Social media definitely plays a big role into that. You feel disrespected at all, or a little bit forgotten, that people want to crown kids that we got coming up now, and not necessarily looking back 10, 15, 20 years and remembering, like, who came before us?
I'm happy. Like, I'm happy to see that the young fellas now, the Coopers and the JPs, having the success that they're having at a young age. I have a lot of pride in it, to be honest with you. Like, that makes me proud that Maine basketball is taking those steps. You know, Maine basketball is on the map, right? Like, when I came out of college, if you said Maine basketball to an NBA guy, to a college guy, they're laughing, you know? And as time goes on, people are gonna start to show a little bit more respect, you know, to the fact that, okay, well, Maine might not historically have been known for basketball, but so why not in the future it be known for basketball? So I have pride with the young fellas that are having success and young ladies who are having success, you know? I think it's great. And I think that at the end of the day, you know, my career and looking back at it, it's just, again, to your point of momentum, it's just part of, you know, the history and the future of Maine basketball, you know, and to be a part of it is a blessing, and to be able to give back and share experiences with these young players moving forward is incredible. Social media is different, which is great. Now there's a platform, it doesn't matter where you're from.
Yeah.
You know, you're gonna be seen and you're gonna be get an opportunity no matter where you're from. And I think that that's great. I think that's something that young boys and girls in Maine should look at as a serious opportunity now. You know, you look at a guy like Cooper, he's the number one freshman in the country. So if you have a number one player in the country, a guy who's, you know, a few years before him, a couple decades before him, who was one of the top players internationally and one of the top players in college basketball, that compounds,
right?
You know, and so then you're going to have a guy who's an NBA player, right? Cooper has the opportunity, you know, to be an NBA player, and not only that, be an NBA star, right? And that's special. That's something that we should all be excited about, support, you know, and share as many experiences as possible. Like, he has Andy Bedard as his coach. Like, Andy Bedard was the guy when I was growing up.
That's one of your guys, right?
He was my guy. I mean, bro, Andy Bedard was the guy. It was him and Cindy Blodgett when I was a kid.
Yeah.
You know, I would tune in when they'd have the games on, like, whatever it was, Maine Public Television or whatever. I'd watch those tournament games, and that to me was like, I was watching them as much as I was watching NBA. That was, to me, the bar. So for him to have the leadership from Andy, and for Andy to give me the opportunity to be a part of it, you know, with Maine Elite, and I'm going to get involved with that squad a little bit. It's just exciting. It's great.
Yeah. And it's like I tell kids now, too. It's like, take advantage of the spotlight on it right now, because people are going to be looking at Maine like they never have before, wondering who, you know, Cooper from Maine, JP from Maine, like, who else is there?
Yeah.
So hopefully these kids take advantage of that opportunity. What role does True have in that, the little thing you and Kobe got? What role do you guys have in helping this next generation?
It's a big deal. We've been building this for 12 years, and it's been a community thing. It hasn't only been Kobe and I. It's been Walt, you know. It's been Jay with Burns Fencing. This has been a community effort. It's free, and it's a responsibility that we have to be able to create opportunities for these kids to learn. And to your point of, you know, this being an opportunity and a momentum point, for these young players like JP and Cooper, there's a lot of other good players too.
Yeah.
There's a lot of other good young fellas, and you look at McKenzie,
yeah,
right? Like McKenzie Holmes, and then you look at the young lady who played at Greeley.
Anna DeWolf is
Anna
a
DeWolf.
Monster. She is a
I mean,
monster.
Yeah,
she's no bigger fan than me.
And when I tell you that Anna's going to have a hell of a career, you know, professionally.
She's a
you
professional
know,
scorer already. She,
yeah,
she's gonna
yeah.
Some money.
And so that's special, and that's the type of trajectory we have, and that's new,
yeah.
Right? Like, we're one of the only states in the United States that has like that new trajectory as far as basketball.
And we got Dom Campbell going to Notre Dame next year.
We got Dom
we
going to Notre Dame.
He's
exactly.
Gonna, he's going to be an
And Dom's
player.
Talented. Dom's been a part of the program for years.
Yeah.
You know, and when you look at the coaches and when you look at the people from our generation, they've been the teachers. They've been the coaches. You look, I mean, they're in this room. Walt, Cobes, Maul, you know, these guys have been a big part of the fact that, you know, with Andy, with Cooper. If Cooper didn't have Andy, right? If JP didn't have the group he's with, if Dom didn't have some of the experiences he had with these coaches, we didn't have that.
Yeah.
Right? Like, so our generation didn't, I had Dudley Davis, I had my high school coach, I had my dad, I had, you know, great leadership, but a lot of players in Maine didn't have that. Now the talent in Maine as far as teaching the game is the best it's ever been. So you look at Ben Tier with what he's done with Sarah, Talon, you know, I think she's one of the most talented young female basketball players in the history of the state. I think she'll prove that at Maine, and I think she'll be a professional and be able to have an opportunity to have a professional career. It's just exciting, you know, and for me and for Coles and for what you've been building with Big Time Hoops, you know, as we collaborate with True, with you, and with other programs here, it's really just about giving back and sharing experiences and using the fact that we've had these experiences that other people haven't ever had in Maine. And that's where the momentum, the tailwind is. The tailwind is all the experiences we've had and the fact that we're willing and we're eager to give back. I think the future is super bright for Maine Hoops.
Give me a hot take before we get up out of here. Last part, just give me like a controversial take or like a bold opinion. Just one last thing to close things out here.
I think Luka's the best player in the NBA.
Okay.
I think Luka's the best player in the league. You know, seeing him grow up, you know, 16 when he got to Real Madrid, what he's done in the league, what he did with Dallas this year, bringing them to the finals, NBA Western Conference Finals. You know, I think that he's a special player. You see what Steph's done. You know, I don't think Steph will get his fourth ring. I think the Celtics are gonna win it this year. But I think that when it's all said and done, Luka is gonna be remembered as the best point guard in NBA history.
Okay, I like that. I'll ask you one last question before we get out of here.
Well,
hot take.
That was for you, coach. I'm just being honest. All I can be is honest. I said Luka.
I
said point guard. Giannis is not a point guard. You got to be able to shoot the ball to be a point guard. Don't tell Magic that.
Yeah. I got one more for you. I don't think we talked about this better rapper, you or J.J. Redick. Both of you guys in the ACC at the same time. There's been some talk about you as a rapper. There's been some talk about JJ is a rapper.
I don't know if there's been talk about
how
JJ.
How much tape you got on there?
There has been talk about me as a rapper.
I know there's been talk about you, but JJ was supposed to have that album come out. It never came out, so obviously he rapped a little bit, but.
So when we were at Jordan's camp, we were in the same dorms for that. And JJ, you know, would freestyle and we would rap a little bit. And I've always been passionate about music.
Yeah.
And it was funny because there was that podcast where Dame was asking, you know, was Cantor Medley playing at Maryland when you were at Duke? And he's like, he was nice. And JJ, because they'd been talking about rapping, thought that, you know, he was talking about rapping. And JJ said, he raps? And I immediately hit up Cobes and I'm like, is he serious? He knows, of course he knows I rap.
Yeah.
So joking aside, I mean, I've always been passionate about music, but JJ was pretty nice. JJ was pretty talented. And you see now with what he's doing with ESPN,
yeah.
He's very articulate, he's well spoken, he's quick. You know, he was more in that phenomena, camina, vamina, vamina, you know, that type of stuff.
Yeah.
I was a little Styles, more Styles P-ish. You know, I was a little more gritty with it.
Yeah.
But you know, I would say if we're gonna be honest, I would say I'm on a little bit of a different level.
Okay. We'll go with that. Other crazy thing too is like looking back on all this, right? Like looking back, like you've been playing for a long ass time, but looking back on it, like it's crazy just the people you've crossed paths with from when you were in high school to now, because you figure like you went to Jordan camps, you played with LeBron in high school, all the ACC stuff with JJ and those Carolina teams, stuff like that, Chris Paul, summer leagues in the NBA, all the young guys that are now all-stars in the NBA. Like you ever like sit back and like look at like just how many people you've crossed paths. Kobe at Rucker.
Yeah.
I went back and found the clip of you getting out the way when he went up for his dunk. I found that, but.
Young wisdom, get out the way.
Yeah. You ever like sit back and think back, like all the people you've crossed paths with from back
then?
Bro,
it's all about relationships, you know, and from when I went to the Jordan Classic and was able to spend time with Amari and Chris Paul and those guys. In AAU with LeBron when he played for the Oakland Soldiers when I was at Pump and Run, to spend time when I was in LA living in Wynwood and playing at UCLA, those open runs, and KD. And Rondo was my roommate when I was with Grover, Jordan's trainer in pre-draft. So building those relationships, what it really did was gave me an example of like being able to see that the very best players, the greatest players are the hardest workers, you know? So there was no excuses for me moving forward. Like these guys are the most talented players I'd ever been around, but they were also the hardest workers, you know? And that's the number one thing that I try to communicate to young players is you tell young players, you gotta work hard. They've heard that before, but it's like, no, but really the best players in the world, the greatest players are the hardest workers, right? And so that is what I consistently saw. So the best part of it, not only was being able to be around these guys, the energy, have those relationships, but to just learn from some great players. My generation was, you know, Carmelo was at that camp, knowing Carmelo, he's from Maryland, he used to come all the time as well. Being at ABCD with LeBron and Lenny Cook, was just great experiences. And, looking back now, the biggest thing I took away from that was just the discipline of these guys and the level in which they worked. And so for me, if I'm me, how can I not work 20 times harder if the guys who are 20 times better and more talented are doing it? So it was a great example for me, and it was something that was a major factor for my work ethic throughout my career, was just seeing what these guys did, the way they carried themselves. I mean, these guys were some of the most humble, cool people that you'd ever meet too, right? Like that was one of the biggest parts for me as well, is being around them and seeing how good people they are and how they carry themselves and conduct themselves was something that also inspired me to, you know, try to conduct myself in a similar way.